Hey, podcast listeners, this is Michael Shelley, and it is a special Shoes edition of the podcast. I've got three interviews with Jeff Murphy from Shoes. The first is from this week, May 10th, 2014, and we discussed their upcoming show in Brooklyn. It was Saturday night, and I heard it was great. I had to travel for Mother's Day, could not be there, but I heard it was great. It's a shorter interview. Then we go to September 8th, 2012. We talk about the Shoes new album. And then we go all the way back to March 3rd, 2007. And that was kind of a more of a general overview of Shoes and the book that Jeff wrote about being in the band. And it was only in real audio, and I had to actually find a way to convert it. And anyway, it was kind of a headache. But it brings us three interviews with Jeff Murphy from Shoes and kind of tells you everything I think you'll need to know about him. A couple great guests coming up. Check out WFMU.org/Michael for the list. And that's about it. I hope you enjoy this three-part interview of Jeff Murphy from Shoes. There is the band Shoes from their brand new record called Ignition, and Jeff Murphy from Shoes. Welcome back. You've been on the show a few different times, and tonight the big occasion is the Brooklyn Power Pop Festival in Brooklyn, playing along with the Paul Collins Beat. How are you?
Oh, great. We're really looking forward to it. It's been, like you say, it's been a while since we played the East Coast, New York, and the surrounding area, so we're jazzed about playing.
You know, I just played Say It Like You Mean It from Ignition, the latest record. You guys have been making records for a really long time, and it's rare that I would play a track, that I would lovingly play a brand new track from a band that's been making records so long. So often I gravitate to people's earlier work or their period of greatness is somewhere in the middle. But you guys have been making great records all along. How many years has it been?
Well, actually, this month marks 40 years, which is crazy long. I mean, it doesn't feel like it. We just feel like, we've just been doing what we enjoy, and that's why we do it. We don't do it to try to become megastars or anything. That's great if you make some money with it, but we just love the genre. We love making music. We love writing songs together, and we've been doing it for 40 years, long time.
That is really a long time. And what is so interesting about your career, and it's very interesting right now as things ebb and flow, a lot of your records are back in print or in print in expanded different formats, new ways, so people can really listen to the whole career of Shoes. And you guys have made everything from 4-track living room records to, 48-track, really expensive records and everything in between. And part of, I think, what makes Shoes sound is that sort of use of the studio as like a fifth member of the band, sort of.
Yeah, we've always loved, Gary and I particularly, are kind of studio rats, I guess you'd say. Butch Vig called us that when we laughed. We just love the technology. That's kind of how we learned. So now that technology has kind of come full circle and people are recording on laptops in their houses and in their living rooms, we're totally comfortable with that because that's sort of how we started. It was a different storage medium where we were recording to tape back then, but now it's just a matter of what shape the button is that you push, but you're still just making music at home. It's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And what about the term power pop? Some people love it, and sort of wear it with pride. Some people absolutely hate it, and some people don't care at all. Where do you guys stand on that label?
Well, it is tough to be pigeonholed into any label, and the term, if I'm not mistaken, was coined by Pete Townsend when he was describing The Who. Huh. And yet most people that would define the power pop genre today would not necessarily include The Who. But I think we would. I mean, to me, power pop is this kind of all-encompassing rock genre that has anything that's melodic. The Who, the Beatles, the Stones, contemporary bands like Fountains of Wayne or Snow Patrol or Collective Soul there's of course bands, Dwight Quilley, Big Star. I mean, it's always been there. It's just a good song with nice vocals and hopefully some harmonies thrown in too.
That's very, you know, I wouldn't have thought of the Who, but I think the early Who certainly, I mean, Baba O'Reilly is not power pop to me, but, you know, certainly the early Who is, but so is Squeeze and lots of other bands that are sort of more song melody oriented.
Like a band like Crowded House is one of those bands that, I mean, I love those guys. And to me, that would it fit in that definition. But most people define power pop in a very narrow scope.
Yeah.
Usually something that sounds very retro Beatles. Hmm. And to me, that is part of it, but just a small part of it. It's an attitude about writing good songs and having a good melody and a good hook. I love guitar hooks. You know, I mean, you know, We Can Work It Out or Day Tripper or Satisfaction. That guitar hook sinks its teeth into you the first time you hear it, and it never goes away. We've all fallen in love with that and have never, you know, it's never gone away for us.
Interesting. And so growing up, is that what you guys were listening to? You guys grew up in around Zion, Illinois. Is that what you guys were listening to, Top 40 radio?
Yeah, absolutely. And at that time, there were really two stations from Chicago that were about all we could get on our little AM radios. But it was the dawn of British invasion, and we were just coming of age at that point. When I say age, I mean awareness. I mean, we were, you know, 10 years old at that time. So when we were just discovering the outside world, suddenly the Beatles and the entire British invasion was thrust on us, and Chicago focused on that. It was a hotbed for that type of music on the radio, and it was great to be weaned on it. And, you know, we fell in love with it, and it just, like I said, never let go.
You guys have a pretty extensive website, shoeswire.com, and there's all kinds of news and about us information and ways to buy stuff or just look through the photos or just look at all the CDs, the records, and there's tons and tons of them. For 40 years, there's obviously people who weren't born who are just discovering your records, you know, 20-year-olds who are just getting into this stuff. Do you hear from those folks? I think before long ago, I probably wrote you guys a letter and one of you guys answered me ages ago. So I think you are a pretty hands-on band, but who does that? Who sifts through the email and answers the folks, and what's that like?
We do. You know, I mean, it's very hands-on. And if it's not me, it's John or it's Gary. We do have help with the technical aspect of maintaining the website, but when it comes to actually making direct contact with people, yeah, that's usually one of us directly. The website is important not only for, like you say, people that maybe didn't discover our music the first time around. Maybe they're 20-something or 30-something, and God bless them. And it's cool that people have, you know, that much of an open mind to look at and discover stuff that has been from the past. But our whole approach as a band has always been, hell, if we can do it, you can do it. I mean, we've always prided ourselves in being just kind of average guys. We came from a very small town in the middle of the Midwest that had zero music scene. It was a dry town, so they had no alcohol, so they had no bars, so they had no clubs to play at. There was no music scene whatsoever, and yet we loved it so much, and our sort of mantra is, if we can do it, so can you. I mean, it's that's what rock music is, the garage bands, you know, and we were inspired by that whole do-it-yourself ethic, and hopefully we can maybe inspire the next guy to pick up a guitar and maybe start his own band.
That's really interesting.
So that's really cool when we hear from people that are, like you say, maybe 20-something that have got a band and they're just getting going.
Yeah. The Shoes records are fantastic in so many ways, but now that I think about it, you're right. It's not about virtuosity of, you know, Eddie Van Halen or shrieking vocals. You know, it does sort of sound like if you just get your creative thing going, you too can do something like this. And, yeah, that's a great message. Like we said, the show is tonight. It's part of the Brooklyn Power Pop Festival at the Bell House, and the Bell House NY is the club's website. It's you guys, Paul Collins Beat, Barracudas and Games at the Bell House in Brooklyn. I've seen Paul Collins Beat fairly recently, and they were great. Really fun, upbeat, and I've seen you guys. You guys are always great. I think it's going to be a good show. I heard from good sources that you guys are planning a set list slightly out of the ordinary.
Yes. Well, we made a point to really kind of touch all bases. We know that a lot of folks, a lot of the people that discover us, usually start with the first Elektra album. present tense, or maybe even Black Vinyl Shoes, you know, the one that we did in my living room. Both of those albums are very well represented tonight, and as well as newer stuff. You know, we don't want to go out as a nostalgia band. It's a continuing thing. We keep writing, but yet we also know where we came from and what songs kind of got us here. So it's a very wide, diverse drawing of songs that really kind of hits on all bases over all of our work.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect balance of reverent to the songs that got you there, but continue with the new great songs. I want to remind everybody, it's Jeff Murphy of Shoes here on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. It's Michael Shelley here, and I've interviewed you a couple times before, and I want to remind your fans tuning in that they can go to WFMU.org/Michael and listen to the full archives of all those past interviews with you and Paul Collins and a bunch of other quote-unquote power pop people and people of all musical stripes over at WFMU.org/Michael, or they can just come see you tonight at the Bell House, New York, in Brooklyn. I have got this song called Burned Out Love queued up now, and the reason I picked this is because it is such a sonic sandwich, and I want you to help me figure out what we're hearing when we hear this record.
We did that record in L.A. We worked with Richard Dashen, who had produced Fleetwood Mac's Rumours album, and had just gotten off of the tour that they were doing for the Tusk album. He'd worked with them on that as well. And we bumped into him at a club, the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A., and I recognized him and went over and started talking. And we had actually wanted to work with him on Present Tense, the first album that we did for Elektra, but he was tied up doing Tusk, so we had a chance to work on it. When we did this song, we had it completely demoed, and we would play, you know, prospective co-producers our demos and say, this is what we want to do. And Richard was all about following those blueprints that we had laid out. And so he was very supportive and very into it. We didn't quite get the kind of growl on the bass guitar that we had on the original demo. If you listen to the double exposure CD where we released the demos of the album, you can kind of hear our initial goal with that bass guitar thing. So, and then the solo, I had just picked up this wacky little electroharmonics synthesizer box, and that's what the solo is this weird little distorted guitar synth box.
Yeah, there's some really crazy guitar sounds. I mean, what is your guys' basic guitar setups for nerds listening, of course?
When we go out, when we tour, Gary usually plays a matchless, and I play high watt. In the studio, it's that maybe a combination of Vox AC30s or you know, some Marshalls that's thrown in there. There's a great company that makes the modern version of the old high watt amplifier called Hi-Tone, and so we use those in the studio too. So we use a bunch of different tools depending on what color we want to try to accomplish.
And do you have like special preamps or pedal things? Or
yeah, you know, Gary's studio, I mean, he's a combination of old and new. He's got the retro, you know, we use the old, these preamps called by this company called API, and we use those going into the recording gear. So it's a combination of analog and digital. You use the analog to kind of get that old time, old school warmth, tube warmth, you know, and then it's stored digitally, and then it's mixed through an analog source to kind of get, again, keep that sort of warmth, that roundness that analog has.
So when you presented this to Elektra, one of the hugest record labels in the world, what do they say?
You know, at that time, Elektra was, when we got signed, we were being courted by a couple of different labels. I remember Seymour Stein from Sire, which was a very up-and-coming, I mean, very progressive and very just cutting-edge label at the time. So when Elektra contacted us, we basically said, you know, here's what we are. They flew in. We played them. We had the whole album demoed. We played them the demo. And their response was, okay, meet us in L.A. We'll be playing tickets at the airport and bring a lawyer. I mean, it was just bing, bang, boom.
Wow. What fun.
You know, just kind of life change.
Yeah, life change. From Zion, Illinois to hanging out with, you know, Fleetwood Mac's producer and making records in L.A. from your living room. Amazing. We'll see you tonight at the Bell House with the Paul Collins Beat, part of the Brooklyn Power Pop Festival. Folks can check out thebellhouseny.com or shoeswire.com for information about Jeff or shoes or whatever is going on. It sounds like it's going to be really fun tonight. Are you guys ready?
We are jazzed. Yeah, we're ready. We are ready.
All right, we will see you there. Thanks so much for visiting with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. We'll see you tonight. Looking forward to it.
Great.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. That is a number one hit song there from Shoes and Jeff Murphy. Welcome back to the program and good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Doing great.
That song, I think, which you wrote, to me is just classic number one hit pop music. There's so much of that in the band's history. That sort of just sort of unpretentious, straightforward, catchy pop music. Would you say that's a fair description of what Shoes are about?
I think that's what we strive to be, yeah. I think that's what we grew up on, and that's what we've always loved in music, is that kind of three-minute dose of just, you know, an endorphin rush from hearing a song that just gets you off.
Very interesting. The band formed in Zion, Illinois, sort of a suburb of Chicago, and 1974, that is about 38 years ago. It's a long time to be in any organization, let alone to band, where egos and money and just being in close quarters are, you know, part of the job description. How have you guys survived?
Well, you know, the way we started, I think, had a lot to do with it. The fact of the matter is, we were friends first. We went to school together, and it was, none of us played instruments, and we thought, wouldn't it be great to have a band? How cool would that be? And we were all into kind of the same thing. Musically, Gary and John were in the same class. I was younger, and so they hit it off, and they would correspond back and forth when they went away to college. Gary went down to the University of Illinois, and they would correspond back and forth about, oh, this band, we're going to do this band, and it was just kind of this pipe dream until that would have been in the, you know, early 70s, and there was no band. It was just a kind of a fantasy. And eventually, we kind of came up with instruments through garage sales and things, and started tinkering around. And I was Gary and I were always gearheads, and we liked gear and recording. And I think the fact that we started that way as friends has been what's maintained, because without the friendship, there is no band. I mean, we're not just going to keep doing it if we can't stand each other's guts, you know.
Well, a lot of people do, you know.
Yeah, that's true. You're very true. I mean, it's the kind of thing that for us, though, I mean, it's all about friendship first. And that's why even when we get together, there is a thing that friends do. There is a politeness that I said recently that when we get together to eat pizza, nobody eats the last piece, because there's always that consideration. Well, you take it. No, you take it. You know, I mean, and I think that that's always been the driving thing behind us, is to stay friends. And the reason for the big gap, I guess you'd say, between new Shoes albums has been we just got busy doing other things. I mean, we all still live very close together, and we're in almost daily contact. And so it was just something that the timing wasn't right. But we were always, we were always just best friends.
Very interesting. And I should point out that John is your brother. You know, you've also been in a band with your brother for 38 years, which, again, for many rock and roll families, does not work for long, long extended periods of time, unless you're in separate buses or, you never see what some guys may have. Yeah, you guys have never been a band that toured a lot. Why is that?
Well, we over the years, we've done hundreds of shows, but they've been, when you spread it out over 38 years, it boils down to a few dozen a year, I guess. I think part of it is, to us, the art form was always the recording, the writing and the recording. That's what we got into it for. That's what we always heard first, was that song on the radio. And then if you got a chance to go see the band live, but I'd say 90% of the bands in my and our record collections, we never had the opportunity to see them live. For us, again, it comes down to scheduling and money. It's very expensive to tour. The costs are very high. People tend not to go out to shows as often now as they did even 20 years ago.
Sure.
So for us, if it's fun, that's the determining factor. If we can do something that we've never done before, we had a chance to tour Japan a couple years ago, so we did that. We've done some shows, bigger shows, where we've opened with other bands that have been a lot of fun to do. But usually when we go out, we're very rarely out for more than, a few weeks at a time. Then we come home and regroup, and then maybe we'll go out and do a few more shows here and there. But if the right opportunity presents itself, we'd love to do a late night thing for Ignition, like a Jimmy Fallon or a David Letterman or something like that. I mean, that would be great fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had the chance to see you guys, and it just was great. You know, it's just like one of those things I'd waited for, and then finally got to hear those songs live. And there's sort of an extra punch to hearing them live, which is, just part of the rock and roll experience.
You kind of strip it down to kind of its basic elements, because obviously in the studio you might be able to play two or even three separate guitar parts, where live you got to kind of homogenize that down into one cohesive part.
Yeah. You guys talked about how sort of your passions is writing these songs and then recording them. And the history of the band is very interesting, because you guys started, as you say, sort of this self-taught thing in your living rooms with a four-track recorder, taking time to make these records sound like you thought rock and roll records should sound. And you end up putting out some local releases and getting a buzz and getting signed to Elektra, a giant company, and making a 48-track record, the sort of jump. And especially at that time, that was a huge concept, and going to Europe and making records. And you discussed this all in a book you wrote a few years ago called The Birth of a Band, The Record Deal, and the Recording of Present Tense. I think we talked about that when you were on the program in 2007. And anybody listening now who wants sort of the long version of your entire life can go back to the archives of that and listen to that again. So it's an amazing story of a band that has sort of seen the record business sort of, explode and then implode. And
it's true. And actually, there is another book coming. I didn't write it, but it's a woman from New York State. She's a professor at Binghamton College, and she's spent years researching and writing, and it's called Boys Don't Lie, A History of Shoes, and it documents exactly what you just talked about. It documents the fact that we've kind of seen the sort of ebb and flow of the music industry over the last 35 years and how we happen to be present and sort of participating witnesses to these very key events along the way of, well, how it started out on vinyl and 8-tracks and cassettes, and that went away in CDs, and MTV rose and fell, and just kind of all these really key things that happened during the course of our tenure. And she spent, like I said, years researching and contacting record company people, and we've had the opportunity to really live a really exciting and really fun life, even though we've never been that kind of platinum-selling band that everybody knows who we are. We've been sort of in and around the industry in a way that we've really kind of been involved in a lot of really interesting things that have happened.
Yeah. You guys are sort of one of those touchstone bands who a lot of bands mention as an influence. And I've noticed that there is sort of a little bit of a resurgence in sort of Midwest pop music. Numero Group is putting out a bunch of compilations of sort of that Chicago, that Champagne, the Illinois sound, and sort of through from that area, you know, the Raspberries and Cheap Trick, and there's tons and tons of bands, and there is something musically similar, and I include Shoes in that too. What is it that was it just you guys all listened to the same songs growing up, and what popped out was similar?
I think so. Yeah, I think that the radio, anyone that lived within radio reception of Chicago mid 1960s, when British Invasion hit, and there was so much going on. It was so exciting because every day the top 10 changed. Every couple of months, your favorite band put out a new album. It was so vibrant and exciting. And the two main stations before FM even happened, AM stations out of Chicago, were WLS and WCFL, and they would play that kind of, you know, Beatles, you know, dominated radio. And but there were also regional bands like the Motown sound and the Boston sound, the Philly sound, San Francisco sound, and it was all kind of centered around that 3-minute pop radio thing. And I think even now, bands that most people might not put in a category of pop, say the Foo Fighters or that band Jet, of course, Fountains of Wayne. I mean, I think we're all influenced by that same sort of melodic structure within that 3-minute song. And Cheap Trick, of course, I mean, they're from Rockford. That's not that far away.
Yeah, there's a real through line musically through all of that music. It's very interesting to sort of hear it coming back and being compiled and stuff like that. Now, I know that Numero's reissuing some of your very earliest records, and they're doing it only on vinyl. Is that right?
Yes, it's really exciting for us to see those records. Some of them have never been released at all. We did 4 albums on a 4-track machine in my living room back before we signed to Elektra. One was called One of Versailles, which we did in, it came out in 75. We pressed out 300 copies of that on vinyl at the time. But it was really sort of meant as a surprise for Gary. Gary was in France going to school, so John and I thought, let's do a record while he's gone. And it was a great learning tool for us because we learned how to not only to get better at writing and recording, but also it was our first sort of step into manufacturing and pressing records. And then we did a record when Gary returned called Bazooka, which never saw the light of day. I mean, it was never released because the drummer that we used at that time quit shortly after we finished. And his girlfriend saw us on stage. We did one gig with him, and his girlfriend said, no, I don't want you doing that. So he quit the band. And we got Skip Meyer joined the band, and he we jumped right into recording the demos for Present Tense. That's another thing that they're going to be released. Well, we jumped right into recording Black Vinyl Shoes. And that is the third one that Numero is releasing. And then after we did Black Vinyl Shoes, we started the demos for Present Tense. And that's what we presented to the record company. And we went into England and recorded the final versions that were released to the public. But we had the entire album already recorded in our own studio. And by that time, we had graduated to 8-track, so we were pretty proud of those demos. And that's what Numero's putting out, is those four records in our demo original versions.
Wow, cannot wait to hear that stuff. I should point out Jeff Murphy is our guest from the band Shoes. Shoeswire.com is their official website, and they've got a pretty comprehensive store there, and the whole Shoes catalog is up there in one form or another, plus a lot of rarities and some hard to acquire things are there, including a 7-inch, which you have bargain priced at $4, and from the Elektra era, which I thought, boy, that's beautiful little artifact.
You know what? Yeah, we had some boxes of those that we had discovered when we sold our studio in 2004 because of the explosion of home recording. We could kind of see the writing on the wall, and even though we had run that studio for over 20 years, we shut it down and closed it, and we had to go through 20 years worth of accumulation, and here we found these boxes of those 7-inch singles that we had gotten from Elektra back in the late 70s. And so we saved them, and we're offering them for sale on the website. I mean, it's a limited thing. I don't know how many we have. We probably have a couple hundred left that we'll sell as we, might as well put them into people's hands rather than sitting in a warehouse.
Absolutely, yeah. You're not running a museum, yeah. Will you guys play gigs in Chicago area because this record is just coming out?
You know, there have been a lot of requests for that, and I think it's probably inevitable that we get out and do something. And like I said, for us, it's a scheduling issue. The drummer that we've used for the last 18 years, who plays on the record, Johnny Richardson, he had played and toured with the Gin Blossoms for the last 3 or 4 years, and he stopped doing that in January. So now he's just sort of, he's always been kind of a hired gun. He's toured with Tommy Keane, and I think he just did a thing with Catch Penny. So he has his own studio, and he runs that, and when we can schedule with him, I mean, he's just really become a very pivotal link for us, because his drumming is so strong, and we're such good friends. He's actually the younger brother of one of our old sound men from when we toured back in the 70s, and he used to say, "Oh, you got to hear my drummer, my little brother play drums," and we were like, yeah, sure, kid brother thing. And then we saw him play, and we were knocked out. He was awesome.
That's funny. Well, I hope you guys do play, and I know that when you do play around Chicago, it's a big scene. You guys are sort of local heroes there. You know, you're rock stars there.
Well, I don't know if I'd say that, but I mean, I think that they there is that pop core in the Midwest that people tend to appreciate that type of stuff. Thank God. I mean, one of our favorite bands that really kind of influenced us in our early days was a band called Big Star. And while they, too, were not that commercially successful at the time or well-known, it's amazing years later how much influence they've had on other bands. And so for us to have bands that say that we've influenced them in some way, that's really a great compliment, because that's the best you can hope for, other than when people write in or say, "I heard one of your songs and it really touched a nerve, and or it helped me get through something, or reminded me of this girl or this situation, and I really appreciate it." That's the best thing you can hope for as an artist.
Yeah, it's funny, because I've heard that more than once, and it's just a sort of one of those basic absolute truths of rock and roll and of making songs, that sort of satisfaction of one person walking up to you and saying, "Hey, that song really worked for me, and here's why." And that's an amazing connection to make with somebody. I have got queued up right now "Say It Like You Mean It" from the band's brand new record called Ignition. It's on the Black Vinyl Shoes label. And like I said, you can get a copy over at shoeswire.com. Jeff Murphy, tell me about this song. It's a song credited to the whole band, right?
All three of us, yes. It started out, Johnny Richardson was playing drums with the Gin Blossoms. And he said, "Hey, Robin said if you guys want him to sing on a song, it'd be kind of cool, because he's a Shoes fan." So I thought, well, let's write a song and have him do that. So I wrote a chorus and gave it to John and Gary and said, "See what you can come up with." And Gary liked the riff that I had kind of trailing in and out, so he used that for the verse. And then John wrote the middle eight, and we just kind of tacked it together, and it's fun. I mean, we do that occasionally where all three of us will sort of take a section and then kind of glue it together, and that's how that song came about. We liked it so much, we thought, oh, let's just leave it like this. We don't need to get Robin. But I still would love to hear him sing it, you know?
That's funny. All right, let's hear it now. Congratulations on being in a band for 38 years, any band, but especially Shoes, just a band I've loved for years and years and years, and the music is sort of timeless, which I guess is why I and so many people over the years have just, you know, treasured this stuff. And Ignition's the new record. Jeff Murphy is our guest. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Rolling off your tongue. Yeah, that is Love Is Like a Bullet from Shoes, and I do believe on the telephone right now, Mr. Jeff Murphy from Shoes. Jeff, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks.
You've just put out a first solo album and a book called Birth of a Band, The Record Deal, and The Making of Present Tense, which is sort of the first major label record for the Shoes. It's a real interesting book. Why now for both of those things?
Well, the CD was actually a couple of years in the works because we sold our studio. We had a commercial studio for about 20 years, and we closed that down about 2 years ago just because it got to the point where it was a pretty big responsibility, and we hadn't done any new Shoes recordings in a couple of years. So we thought, well, let's just pare down. The industry had changed. The big studios were kind of fading. So we built, Gary and I at least, put home studios in, and that slowed things down. And it just, considering the amount of time that it takes to write, or at least it takes me to write a song, it's about equal to three albums worth of normal Shoes writing.
Right, because in the Shoes it was a very democratic sort of writing structure. Everybody got a few cuts on an album, and here you are. You got to write all the cuts. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the band. You and your brother John and your friend Gary, your high school mates in Zion, Illinois, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere. What was Zion like? What was it like growing up there?
It was, you know, as a kid, it was great. It was very sort of Mayberry-esque. But as we got older, it became apparent that a lot of things that we wanted to do, you couldn't really do. There was absolutely no music scene at all. And when we decided to start playing, which was really out of high school by the time we said, hey, let's have a band, we started from zero. I mean, we didn't know how to play anything. We never had any music lessons. So it was really just the desire to, wouldn't this be fun kind of pipe dream. As we started to try to do things, we realized, well, Zion was a dry community, for one thing. There was no alcohol, which meant no bars, no clubs, no place to play, really. But we were located about halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee on the shores of Lake Michigan there. And so it was. We really had great radio, and that was a huge inspiration to us.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you. It seems like guys who went to high school around when you did took their influences and started this thing, which we sort of call power pop. And the Shoes are a band that is really synonymous with the word power pop. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, it can be a negative to be associated with any one particular style.
Sure.
Because it can be confining. If people go in with a certain expectation, we just write what comes naturally. And that's part of the reason why the solo thing took so long, too. Was we were never really the kind of band to write 100 songs and choose the 10 that we liked the best. We only wrote when we, you know, it's kind of the Mr. Ed thing. We only spoke when we had something to say. And so that's why we really try to just do things that we felt as opposed to doing what people expected. And the power pop pigeonhole can be a little confining, but yet I think that that's a very broad category.
Yeah, well, why do you think it is that folks, you know, like I said, guys who sort of were listening to things you know, guys around your age were, like, you know, people talk about the Knack and bands like that sort of all exploding. It's really something that sort of turned into sort of new wave, just non-bombastic rock music, really. But what was it about what you were listening to or growing up and taking in society, you think, that made the Shoes sound like the Shoes?
Well, for us, it was always first and foremost melodic, but just that melodic with rock, you know, undertones. And, you know, having been completely obsessed with the Beatles as a kid, and bands like even Polar Bear and the Raiders, which you know, did the hokey costumes and all that, but they really had some great songs. It had to be memorable, something that you wanted to hum along to. That was sort of the criteria, but yet we liked the sort of edginess of a paper, you know, when I heard that guitar tone in Paperback Writer, I was like, yeah, okay, this is where I want to, this is what I love. That's the stuff that really launched that whole thing for us. And when you see bands like Bad Finger or back in those days, Big Star was a huge influence on us as well. Hmm. It just really inspired us to be rock but yet melodic at the same time.
Well, you talk about the sound of the band, and the technical sound of the band is really different from a lot of other records out there. And I think there's one Shoes record that says, you know, no keyboards are used on the making of this record. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of weird sounds that you guys were sort of inventing yourself. Where did that whole thing come from?
Well, you know, they say that necessity is the mother of invention. And when we were first starting, we couldn't really afford anything too elaborate. And one of the things that I had built was a little distortion unit that was made from the guts of an old tape recorder I had when I was a kid. And it had a very particular sound to it. Every piece of electronic gear has a very particular sound to it. And as we would experiment with just getting different, I mean, not having any training in recording or any of that stuff, we did things our own way. And for better or for worse, the records started to sound a little weird because of it. We liked the fact that they sounded different.
Yeah.
But people kept saying, you know, who's playing the keyboards? And that's why we put that note on there that would say no keyboards. We were really proud of the fact that these were all just sounds that we were creating using non-keyboard things. Not that we have anything against keyboards. It's just that it's so easy to get caught up in that trap of overproducing something with tons of keyboards. And we've fallen victim to it ourselves in later records, where we would, where we did incorporate the use of keyboards at times, and it's very easy to just pull you in where suddenly you're becoming so reliant on that it makes it more homogeneous.
Hmm. It's interesting that you guys went from being these sort of early sort of you know self-taught. You're building your own stuff and you're buying equipment. You're doing your own printing, and you know you started doing your first home recordings, you know, on 4-track pretty much right away. And you even bought a machine that pressed up records, is that right?
Well, yeah, it was actually a lathe. It cut records where a little thread of vinyl was cut off that you had to pull along.
So you make one at a time.
You make one at a time, and it was in real time. You played the record, or you played the tape, and into the machine, and it was cutting the grooves as you pulled the waste plastic away from the machine so it didn't clog the head.
And is that how you distributed your first recordings?
The very first thing we did, yeah, was called Heads or Tails, and it was 10 songs, incredibly primitive and crude, but it was really just, it's how we learned. I mean, we just went right out there, and you know, we cut 4 copies of that record, and then moved right on to doing the next one, and we sort of move past that very first record. We don't like to talk about that one too much because it was so crude, it's so embarrassing, but yet it was, you know, it was really what we cut our teeth on.
I guess, you know, part of the thing of being brought up in a town that didn't have a music scene must be part of the reason why you guys always concentrated on recordings and not playing live constantly. You know, it was
I think that was part of it. There was the tremendous pressure from the area musicians and, you know, like the Chicago area. Everyone that we talked to kept saying to us, oh, you got to play live. You know, that's how you do it. You got to play live. And we would say, wait a minute, of all the bands I've seen play live, how many actually got record deals? You know, very few. Hmm. To us, it made much more sense looking at my own record collection, I would have 100 albums, and I would say, how many of these bands did I buy the record because I saw them live, as opposed to I heard it on the radio? So to us, it made more sense to go right to people with the finished product, and then go out and play live to support the product.
Interesting. So you guys did make this record called Black Vinyl Shoes around 1976, 77, and you started sending that one out to folks, and there was a real, I mean, unprecedented critical groundswell around that.
Really, that changed our lives. That record changed our lives because it happened at a time when that sort of punk, even it later became, they mutated into what they called new wave, but that do-it-yourself attitude, and not only in the making of music, but also writers and people that wanted to be critics started their own little publications called fanzines. It was really like a resurgence of music in the mid to late 70s that was really exciting. There was tons of new bands, and it just really seemed like a lot of action. So when we came out with Black Vinyl Shoes, the press just jumped on it and really said, wow, look at these guys did a whole album on their own, and it was just perfect timing for us.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. There's a lot of things about the Shoes story that are, you know, textbook of what could happen to a band at that time, and it's so interesting that you guys did this, and it's almost like you ruined it for a lot of bands. I think everyone heard the story. There's these guys in this small town. They just sent their record out to a few people, and they end up getting signed to Elektra Records. I know it wasn't that easy, but I think that is sort of part of the legacy of the Shoes, you know?
The amazing thing to us was that it seemed like we were always moving forward. It kept progressing, where we would do the next record, and then more good things would happen, and then maybe some more press would come, and then that would inspire us to write some more stuff. And then when Elektra came along, like you said, it was the perfect rock and roll fantasy of these guys doing tapes at home, and then a record label comes along and signs the band. But we were really functioning as if we didn't need the label, even though, we wanted to get signed because of the mass audience that they can reach on your behalf. Nowadays, it's a lot different, but that was sort of the point of the book I was writing, was that it can be done. Anybody can do it, and it was really a tribute as much to the fact that we were friends, and that was that. I think that's one of the things that people miss a lot nowadays. I mean, you know, when you see these super groups get together and they get the best guitarist and the best vocalist and the best drummer, that's not necessarily going to be the best band, because the chemistry between the individuals is that intangible that makes it interesting, I think.
I think you're right. I also think there's just something different about the whole time and the whole industry. And if you sent a record, you know, to the guy at the Village Voice today, it would just be in a giant pile and ignored. You know, it just what happened to you guys couldn't happen. It seems like, according to what's in the book, the band The Cars had just been signed to Elektra,
yes,
and they were having huge success. And Elektra didn't have a million rock bands at that time, and they were like, okay, we need to find, you know, The Cars version 2. And you guys seem like the natural thing. So you go from making a 4-track record on your own to a giant manor in England with 48 tracks to make, you know, your big debut, Present Tense. And that's pretty much what the book is all about, the making of that record.
Yeah, and that came about kind of by accident. I was in the middle of recording the solo CD, Cantilever, and my wife and I had gone for a weekend on vacation, and I stumbled across at a rummage sale, a scanner that had a slide attachment, because I didn't own one of those. And I picked it up and took it home, and I thought, you know, I had taken all these beautiful slides when I was in England recording Present Tense 30 years ago or 25 years ago, and I had never made prints of those. So I scanned them, and when I did, I thought, well, that might make an interesting sort of behind-the-scenes look at how that all happened and how it came about.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, how do folks get the book?
Well, they can go to our website. That's probably the easiest way, which is www.blackvinyl.com, and all of our CDs are available there, as well as the solo CD, the book, and other trinkets.
Yeah, you guys continue to make records. You know, there's five or six records after this one and some live stuff and some archival stuff that you've put out. And you did eventually do some touring. I've seen you guys live, and it's and there, a few different drummers have sort of come and gone, but the core of the group still remains. But you haven't guys been active in a while. Is there going to be any new Shoes? Have you broken up, or will it ever happen again?
Well, Shoes, we never broke up. We still remain friends. We're in contact literally daily. We email back and forth. There is a new Shoes release coming, even though it's I'll call it older material, but what it is, it's called Double Exposure. It's a double CD, and it's 30 songs that we had recorded in our what became our 8-track studio back in 78 through 1980 that eventually became the album Present Tense and then the second record, Tongue Twister. It's those songs in the demo form that we presented to the record company.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, I want to tell the folks, keep their eyes on blackvinyl.com. Jeff, the new record's Cantilever, and the book is called Birth of a Band, The Record Deal, and The Making of Present Tense. And they're both interesting, and like I say, the Shoes are just sort of this, a legendary band for a lot of people. So how does it feel to be part of that?
Oh, it's wonderful. I love it. I love the industry. I never lost that thrill of making a song and listening back to it. It's a great rush.
That's a perfect, yeah. Do fans still contact you guys constantly?
Oh, yeah. We get a lot of email. We get a lot of letters. And our audience has always been very spread out, as opposed to having a concentrated core in a specific location. We get emails and fan letters from all over the place, including Europe. Europe actually was a little bit ahead of the United States at when we did Black Vinyl Shoes. I think that sort of led credibility back in the States, because the UK press and the French and even the Germans started to pick up on that record and write about it. And just accept it as a finished record.
That's interesting. That happens often, where you've got to sort of get success outside the U.S. and then come home.
And then it filters back. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to visit with us and try to stay warm over there.
Oh yeah.
All right, Jeff. Thank you so much, and good luck.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye bye.
All righty. Bye bye.